Exodus chapter 20. It's hard to believe, but our summer series is over, and maybe it's fitting because summer seems to be over. Well, we've come to the last command, the 10th command, here in Exodus chapter 20. The other day I was driving back and had a little time on my hands, and so I was listening to the Dave Ramsey show on the radio, and oftentimes, a little bit, I've listened to him. He can give some helpful financial advice. He's a believer, definitely runs in different circles, but does come at it from a moderately evangelical perspective. But this show on Thursday was the Millionaire Call-In Show. And he wanted those people that were millionaires to call in, and he asked them a series of questions to try and demonstrate to all the listeners that millionaires are pretty much just average, ordinary people. They're not evil people, as is often presented in the media, and it's not just Hollywood stars and sports stars that become millionaires. Actually, they're a very small percentage of millionaires. And so I suppose the idea of the show was intriguing. It piqued my interest, and I caught the interviews of several of these folks that had become millionaires. And he asked them questions to try and demonstrate, again, that millionaires aren't evil, that two, they're not normally geniuses. Some of them didn't even have college degrees who are millionaires now. And that three, they don't usually inherit the money. He's trying to disprove all these misconceptions, these false theories about how people become wealthy. And what he demonstrated as he interviewed these folks, and it was interesting, was that generally millionaires are people who do several simple things. One, they stay out of debt, they don't borrow money. Two, they budget their money very carefully, they don't spend more than they're bringing in. You say, duh, yeah, I know it's simple, but... And three, they read books. They read books. And so you'd ask them, what's the most recent nonfiction book that you read? And all of them could point to a book that they had just read. So he was communicating, they're like you, except they do these things. And his point is you can do these things too. So it was interesting in one sense because it did confirm Dave's theory about millionaires. But in another sense, as I analyzed it, I think it sent the wrong message from a Christian perspective. After he got to the end of the interview with them, he'd tell them, "You are my hero." In other words, you've done it. Great job. Fantastic. You haven't spent money crazily. You've been wise with it. And you've made your million or more. One of them, one of the guys who didn't even have a college degree, he was now worth over $6 million. Well, as I thought about it, I understood what he was trying to accomplish. He was trying to erase the stereotype about rich people. But as one of these listeners who admittedly said, because he would ask him about their giving too, because Dave comes at it as a believer, asked this man about his giving, and the guy said something like this: "Well, I give, but because we're not connected to any kind of faith, it's not through that." So he'd probably give to just general nonprofits. And so Dave said, "You're my hero," and it kind of made this hair on the back of my neck stand up. Well, yeah, in a financial sense, maybe so, but here's this guy who's not even a believer, who's not giving to things that matter to the Lord, and he's not our hero. So from that standpoint, I thought the show left something to be lacking. But another standpoint is that there were probably many believers who were listening to that show and listening to what Dave had to say that day that walked away with a new life goal. I'm going to be a millionaire. I can do it. And there are many millionaires who are godly people. In fact, some of the wealthiest people I know are some of the most godly people I know. But if we make it as our ambition to be rich, to be a millionaire, to make it, then probably we are dangerously close, if not already having stepped over the line, of becoming discontent, which is exactly what the 10th command drives at. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. We've had these little short commands here, and all of a sudden we come to a little longer one again. It's still one verse in our translation. But he says in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, "You shall not covet." The word means to desire. "You shall not desire your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." Probably the danger of sharing that opening illustration was that we might sit back and say, "Well, I don't care whether I'm a millionaire or not. I don't care about being greedy. Money is not what my life is about. Woo! I'm off the hook today. Start thinking about lunch." Well, I want to uncover, kind of peel away, like we're peeling an orange, and get down to the very core of what coveting is about, because it goes far beyond just a desire to be rich. For some, it's evidenced by a desire to get money or wealth or property. But for other people, it has nothing to do with money, and yet their covetousness manifests itself in a variety of ways. What is the essence of coveting? What is the core of coveting? What can we peel away and find out is left when we get right down to it? Well, he gives us the command there very clearly: "You shall not covet your neighbor's house." It's important for you to understand as a believer that the word covet is not in itself a bad word. Oftentimes in the Old Testament, it's translated as desire. It's kind of like the New Testament word for lust or desire. It can be a positive desire, it can be a negative desire, depending on what you are desiring, what you are placing your desire on. If it's something that God forbids, then obviously appropriate translation would be coveting, because it's a bad desire. There are good things that God wants us to desire. He wants us to pursue His kingdom and His righteousness. He wants us to pursue lost souls. He wants us to desire that lost people would be saved. So it all depends on the context. And very clearly here, he's talking about a bad desire, because he puts it off limits. And so it's an appropriate translation: "You should not covet." But it's talking about a strong desire, a longing for something. And here it's a problem, because it's a desire, a longing for something that belongs to somebody else. And that's the problem. The command's repeated in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 21, where Moses reminds them before they enter the promised land. He says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire your neighbor's house." He adds one in here: his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. You say, "Pastor Michael, I have never coveted somebody's ox. I've never coveted my neighbor's donkey. And you should see my neighbor's house. I don't want his house either." Well, what's he driving at? He says, "Your neighbor's house." And I want to point out at the outset, because I think it's important for us to understand this concept, probably very few of us on a regular basis go around, I hope not, wishing ill on the people sitting around us. You know, "I wish God would take Pastor Bob's house away from him and he was out on the street." And why would I think that? Why would I want that? "I wish God would take Will's truck away from him so he couldn't make a living. I really wish he would do that." That's what we kind of assume coveting it is, that God's got to take what He has, and He's got to give it to me. And certainly that's a violation of this command. But more often than not, for us, as for those of us who are believers, I think it works something more like this. It's not that I want Pastor Bob's house for myself. I want God to take it away from him and give it to me, because I have spite in my heart towards Pastor Bob. It works like this: "You know, I could really use a house like that. It doesn't have to be his house. It just needs to be something like that." And I just picked Pastor Bob's house in random here, okay? I'm not picking on Pastor Bob. Or, "You know, I could really use a work truck like Will has. I mean, it doubles as a camper when he goes out into the woods. I mean, how can it get any better than that?" It's not that I want God to take it away from that person so much, but I could use a car like that. Or why didn't my parents leave me an inheritance like so-and-so got? I'm happy for them to have it. That doesn't bother me. But what bothers me is that I don't have one like that. And what is that? That's coveting. Even if I don't want you to lose it, if God has given it to somebody else and hasn't given it to me, and yet I still strongly desire it and want it, God calls that coveting. It's a violation of the Ten Commands. He says, don't covet your neighbor's house. He says also, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. He says, your neighbor's wife doesn't belong to you, so you can't touch her. And for ladies, your neighbor's husband doesn't belong to you, and so you can't touch him. Maybe we struggle with that temptation. There are many believers who fall prey to adultery. But often it starts with something like this. There's conflict in a relationship, and they're not forgiving and working through these things and dealing with sin and keeping short sin accounts with each other. So the frustration builds up. And so you see somebody at work, and maybe you're not even interested in immorality with that person, but you start thinking things like this. I wish my husband was as understanding as this guy is. Or I wish my husband was this sensitive. Why doesn't my husband do it this way? Or maybe a husband thinks, I wish my wife took care of herself like this lady does. Why do my coworkers look attractive, but when I come home, my wife hasn't taken care of herself at all? And it starts with thoughts like that. It doesn't usually start with, I want to commit immorality with this person. It starts with longing after characteristics that they have, personality traits, physical attributes, and saying, why doesn't my spouse have that? God says, they don't belong to you, so you can't think that way. Don't even think that way is what God is saying. You notice there's no punishment here listed for coveting. Why is that? How will I know whether you're a covetous person or not? It may come out as you violate some of the other commands, but God is the one who polices this, right? I can't enforce this. Well, stop coveting. I can see it in your eyes. Probably not. He says, don't covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant. We could apply this in our day to our job situation. I deserve a better job. Why hasn't God given me a better job? I work harder than so-and-so, and he got the promotion. He says, don't covet his job. Don't covet his ox or his donkey. That church member has that John Deere lawnmower with a 48-inch blade that can just knock out their property, and here I mow our lawn with a weed eater. That's coveting. And somebody else in the church says, well, be thankful you have a weed eater. I mow my grass with my fingernail clippers because I can't even... And it goes on. It never stops. It says, don't covet his ox or his donkey. He says, or anything even that belongs to your neighbor. It can come in the most innocuous of desires where a lady wants children and God has closed her womb and hasn't given her children, and she comes to resent the fact that there are other ladies that have kids and she doesn't want their kids. She just wants God to give her kids, and so she becomes upset. That's coveting. Or somebody who's not satisfied with the physique that God has given them. I deserve better than this. Why didn't God make me this way? What I want to demonstrate to you here this morning in the core of our message is that though we can't see coveting going on in the heart, we'll usually see the effects of it. I want us to evaluate this morning how many of the other 9 commands can be violated because of a covetous heart. In other words, does a covetous heart lead you to violate any of the other commands? Let's start at the very beginning, the first command. You say, coveting has nothing to do with the command to have no other gods before God. Does it? What are covetous people at heart? According to the New Testament, they are idolaters. Covetousness is idolatry. Covetous people love other gods. They're not satisfied with the God they have. Their God hasn't done enough. He hasn't given them kids. He hasn't given them the physique. He hasn't given them wealth. He hasn't given them the job. He didn't give them the parents that they deserved. He hasn't given them the life circumstances that they deserve. Covetous people are idolaters. They put other gods before God. In other words, at the heart of it, covetous people are saying, God is not enough for me. He doesn't satisfy my heart. That's why I chose songs today about satisfaction in Christ, because it's the antidote to being covetous. Satisfied people are content people. They're not frustrated, discontent. I want you to turn over to Genesis chapter 3, please. I'll show you a couple illustrations here. The last couple years here at Foundation, it's been a new phenomenon for me, because now when I tell people to turn, I'm used to hearing pages turn and it's quiet because you're flipping through on your phone or your iPad, and that's okay. It just makes for a different sound in the congregation. At least I'm assuming that you're turning. Maybe you're not. Genesis 3 and verse 6. This, of course, is the fall of the human race into sin. Satan tempts Eve. And look at the heart of covetousness here as revealed in Genesis chapter 3. Verse 6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable. There's our word for coveting. Desire. It was something you strongly desire. It was desirable to make one wise. She took from its fruit and ate. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. So she saw, she desired, she took. And then what happened next? They hid and they suffered. Go over to Joshua chapter 7 for the same pattern. I'm trying to establish a pattern here. Joshua chapter 7. Joshua chapter 7. The Israelites cross the Jordan River. God gives Jericho into their hands and he's told them, do not take anything. Everything there belongs to me. Well, one fella, Achan, one Israelite, decides that he knows better than God, but let's see what caused him to do this great sin. In verse 20, after he's questioned by Joshua, verse 20 of Joshua chapter 7, so Achan answered Joshua and said, truly, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar, and 200 shekels of silver, and a bar of gold, 50 shekels in weight. And then I, here's our word, coveted, I desired them, and took them. And behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it. Do you see the same language that was used from Genesis chapter 3? I saw, I desired, I took, and I hid. I hid. We don't want people to know about our covetousness because we're taking something that doesn't belong to us. So we invariably have to hide it. And as a consequence, we saw in Genesis chapter 3 with Adam and Eve, a consequence for Achan, what always follows the coveting, suffering. Suffering. You bring suffering upon yourself. Here's the pattern. See, covet, take, hide, and then suffer. Maybe you violate the command not to steal because you take something that belongs to somebody else. Maybe we take in other ways, more refined ways in our modern days. Maybe we go into debt on our credit card because I've got to have. Very similar idea. So coveting leads to a violation of the first command. How about the second command where God tells them not to worship Him in the wrong way, to worship the right God the right way? Does this ever happen? Sure. This would be a temptation for those in my profession in particular. You know, there are lots of churches in Calgary that are bigger than ours. What's the difference between their church and ours? Well, this is different, this is different. Aha, music. You know, if we just change the music, we could get what we really want. We want a bigger church, right? This pastor wants a big. So let's change the music. Does this happen? I was just talking to a believer a few weeks ago from another church. And he was expressing his disdain that their church has chosen a popular form of music. He was disappointed with that, but he said, you know what, I got to say, it really gets the people in the seats to hear the message. Violation of the second command. If I want a bigger congregation, I know what to do. Okay, I could change this, I could change this. Coveting can lead to disobeying the command to worship the right God the right way. How about the third command? Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. How would this be connected to coveting? Well, somebody gets angry that God hasn't given them what they think they need, so they curse God. Or maybe they make their life all about getting what they want because they don't think God has given it to them. And so they dishonor the Lord's name by living a hypocritical and worthless life. Coveting leads to using God's name in a flippant way before unbelievers. How about the fourth command? Say, Pastor Michael, there's no way you can get coveting in the fourth command to connect here. Well, think about it. Somebody who wants to get ahead at the workplace, their coworkers are working on the Lord's day. They're making progress. If they're going to make progress in the company or even keep up, if I don't work on Sunday, my coworkers are going to get ahead of me. Coveting can lead to dishonoring the fourth command. How about the command to dishonor your parents? My parents don't give me what I need, so I fight with them because I don't like that they're not giving me what we need, or they won't let me do what I think I ought to do with my friends. So they fight. Coveting can lead to dishonoring the parents. How about a foolish son who spends his life for that which doesn't matter? I remember being down at Camp Ironwood a few years ago for a conference for a mission board. And then this little beautiful lodge, log cabin that they had constructed. They had all these mounts of a polar bear skin and a buffalo head and all these other things that this fella who had spent his life, who had given his life to hunting, extreme hunting, had collected all of these mounts and gone to Africa, and he had all kinds. It was some neat stuff, really neat mounts. But the tragedy was he had spent his entire life, he had basically cut himself off from his family so that when he died, there was not one of his family members that wanted his stuff. And so what happens? It ends up at a camp. An object lesson to all these kids. Don't covet what God hasn't given you. Don't waste your life on things that don't matter. What a powerful lesson. Proverbs 17:25, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to him who bore him. Coveting can lead you to dishonor your parents. How about the sixth command, murder? Turn over to James chapter 4. James chapter 4, some of you may have already thought of that verse before we got to it. James chapter 4. James chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, he talks about where fighting comes and he describes it as coming from our lusts, from what we covet, what we desire, we think we must have. A desire, even a legitimate desire, becomes a demand. I must have this. So in verse 1, he says, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your desires, your lust, your pleasures that wage war in your members, in your body parts. You lust, you desire, and you do not have, so you commit murder. You are in the way of what I want, and so I've got to get rid of you. You say, we wouldn't do that. By God's grace, I hope not. But does it happen? Sure. How many times in political elections does somebody just go dead all of a sudden? How about poor Naboth, godly Naboth? What did he have? He didn't do anything wrong. He just had a family vineyard. And Ahab pouted because he didn't want it. So Queen Jezebel had the authority. And what happens? They lie about him. They slander him. They break the ninth command of bearing false witness. And they kill him and then they steal his property. Multiple commands being violated, all because Ahab was covetous. It can lead to murder. Sometimes it leads to adultery, the seventh command. Maybe somebody says, my wife doesn't satisfy me, I deserve pleasure, and so they plunge into adultery. I want to experience the beauty of this other person that God hasn't allowed me to experience. God hasn't let me get married, so I'm going to take it. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 6. I really want you to see this passage. Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 are passages that deal with purity. And if purity is a struggle for you, you need to really become friends with Proverbs 5, 6, and 7. Because in Proverbs chapter 6, in verse 24, he talks about the teaching of his parents. He says, listen to my teaching, Solomon says to his sons. Listen to my teaching. What they will do, verse 24, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress, the foreign woman, the woman who lives contrary to God's revealed biblical principles. Look at what he says here in verse 25. Here's our key phrase for this morning. Do not desire, that's the word for covet. Do not covet, lust, desire after her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. That's the look. We all know what the look is. That's the look. It says, don't fall for it. Verse 26, he tells us why. He says, for on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. And then he goes on and describes all the consequences of coveting and then taking some pleasure that doesn't rightfully belong to you. He says, don't desire her beauty in your heart. Don't lust after her beauty in her heart. Here is probably the clearest Old Testament passage on what Jesus says, that to look is to commit heart adultery. He says, coveting will lead to adultery. Paul makes a connection in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 5, where he says sexual sin is covetousness. Because God hasn't given to me, I think I can take it. And God says, it doesn't belong to you. If I wanted you to have it, I would give it to you. So the challenge is for single people as well. Sometimes ladies, sometimes men too, daydream about what it would be like to marry somebody else, and God says, don't do it. Coveting leads to adultery. Coveting also leads to violating the eighth command, stealing. I deserve what you have, so I'm willing to take it. But leads to violation of the ninth command, as we saw with Ahab and Jezebel and Naboth, slandering him, lying about him, saying he had cursed God. I deserve your job, so I'll slander you to get it. That ever happen at your office? People ever willing to step on somebody else to make an advance? Or I deserve your reputation, so I'll lie about you to get it. What I'm trying to demonstrate here, friends, is that discontented covetousness can lead to every kind of sin imaginable. Isn't this what Paul was driving at in 1 Timothy verse 6? Chapter 6 and verse 10, where he says, the love of money, discontent, greed, is the root of all kinds of sins imaginable. That's what Paul was saying. Coveting, desiring what God hasn't chosen to give me, or maybe somebody else worked harder to get it. Could be various reasons why I don't have it, but desiring to have what God hasn't chosen to give me. And when we peel away all the extra, all the fluff, and we get down to the core, this is what coveting is. And thus defined, I think we would have to say that many of us, even believers, regularly violate the 10th command. So what's the solution? I'll suggest four ideas. First of all, guard your heart from discontent. There's an old Puritan classic called The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. Some of you may have read it, and it is a rare jewel. It's hard to find. There, Proverbs 4:23, Solomon says, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. He's picturing a spring here, and he's saying, your heart is like that spring. It's the source of everything that comes out of your life. And he says, if the source is polluted, then everything downstream is going to be polluted. If your heart is covetousness, if your heart is filled with covetousness and discontent, then what comes out of your life is going to be polluted. It has to be. So he says, guard your heart from discontent. Paul said in Philippians 4, verse 11, I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. It's something we have to learn as believers. It's something we have to work on, and God has to change us. It's not natural to me. Sometimes I run into folks that are frustrated with God, and they wouldn't phrase it this way, but when you get right down to it, they're frustrated because they think they would have turned out better if God had just given me a good Christian home. That's discontent. That's coveting. If God wanted you to have good Christian parents, He would have given you good Christian parents. We look at the example of Joseph and Ruth. They didn't have godly Christian parents, and I'm not diminishing the significance of that. I'm grateful for the ones God gave me. But if God knew you needed good Christian parents to grow up into a mature believer, then He would have given you that. So don't be discontent that your family background was different than somebody else's. Could be with sickness, it could be with any kind of trial. If this just wasn't in my life, then it would be so much better. I want to encourage you that one of the ways that we fuel our discontent is by listening to advertising. This is all that TV is, really. So I can't point to a chapter and verse. I can't give you an explicit command for what I'm going to suggest to you. It's just hopefully a good idea. Don't put it in your notes. But number one, and I think I can point to biblical principle, maybe not an explicit verse, don't watch a lot of TV. Don't watch a lot of TV. Discontented people are usually people who spend a lot of time watching TV. And number two, when you do watch TV, here's a suggestion. This is not Bible truth, okay? This is just an application. Turn off the advertisements. Why? Number one, because they're going to fill them with garbage. And number two, the entire purpose of advertising is to create discontent in your heart. So if you want to guard your heart from discontent, don't fall prey to it. Cut off those influences as much as you can. If you're having a bad day, you're not feeling good, don't go out to the mall. The mall is never the answer to having a bad day. What it's going to do is you're going to feel bad for yourself and you're going to end up buying something on credit that you can't afford. Don't fuel discontent. Learn to be content. Number two, not only guard your heart from discontent, let's go back to James chapter 4 and verse 3. This is the last reference I'll ask you to turn to. It's there on your handout as well, I believe, if you just want to look there. But it's very significant. We left off. Discontent can lead to murder. He says in verse 2, you lust and you do not have, so you can commit murder. You're envious and you cannot obtain, so you fight. It leads to disunity in a church. You have a church that's fighting and you can guarantee there are discontent people there. But look at verse 3, or the end of verse 2 and then on into verse 3. He says, you do not have because you do not ask. So what's the solution to discontentment? Simply to ask God to provide what you need. Will He do that? Sure He will. He says in Hebrews 13, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for He has promised, I will never leave you, nor I will forsake you, so that we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I won't be afraid. What can man do to me? Here's the core solution to overcoming discontent. The promise of God's presence with you. The promise of God's presence with us and His promise to provide for us should free us from this discontent, the I wants of life. I want this. I should have this. I need this. I need more godly kids. I need this. I need this. The promises and the presence of God should free us from discontent, the I wants of life, and also the fear, the what ifs of life. I don't have to be afraid of the what ifs because I have a God who's going to provide what I need. And if He doesn't give me something, then I don't need it. Number three, pursue God and His Word. To put on right habits, you got to pursue God and His Word. Our word for coveting is used in a good sense in Psalm 19, verse 10, where the songwriter says, the Word of God is more to be desired, coveted. The Word of God is more to be desired than the best gold. Pursue something that really matters and that can really satisfy your heart. Friends, it's a faith issue. Can God satisfy your heart? If so, then obey his command in Matthew 6:33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. I'll take care of what you need. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 6, he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be, New American Standard translates it, satisfied, filled. Isaiah asks the question in chapter 55 and verse 2, why would you spend your energies pursuing what can't satisfy? Did Eve get what she was looking for? No, she didn't. Did Achan get what he was looking for? No, he didn't. Covetousness never leads to satisfaction. A man who takes somebody else's wife never ends up satisfied. Why spend your energies pursuing what can't satisfy? Isaiah says, seek the Lord while he may be found. Pursue him. Pursue God and his word. And finally, and I think here's the key, thank God for what he has provided or hasn't provided at this time. I run into believers with pretty good lives overall, and they're complaining, always hoping that something will change, and I do this too. Instead of wishing I had more, I should spend time thanking God for what I do have. And you know what will happen? The contentment level will rise and the dissatisfaction will go down. They work in inverse proportion all the time. And really, every time I desire something that belongs to somebody else, I'm expressing disappointment with God. And that's what we've got to face. If I'm discontent, I'm frustrated with God. And what do I have to be frustrated with God about? I get there. I was probably there yesterday. I get there. I get it. I understand. But every time I'm frustrated, I'm expressing disappointment with God when I'm discontent. So what's the answer to coveting? Godly contentment. Would you bow your heads, please? We started our worship time today from Psalm 107, where we are commanded to give thanks to the Lord for his loving kindness and for his wonders to the sons of men. For he has satisfied the thirsty soul and the hungry soul he has filled with what is good. There are people here this morning that almost have nothing of this world's goods or prestige or reputation or pleasures, and yet their souls are filled. Why is that? Because contentment is not based on what you have, it's based on who you know. And if you know the God of heaven, then our soul should be filled. If your soul isn't filled, put into practice what the Bible teaches and see God satisfy your heart. Only he can satisfy. Let's look to him and ask him to give us what we need.